The shofar is found, not manufactured. I can imagine a shepherd in ancient Israel bending down beside the carcass of a ram, picking up its outworn horn, breathing into the narrow end and surprising himself that his silent breath suddenly becomes a shrill blast. Man is nothing if not clever. And soon society discovered that this blast could carry farther than any human cry. And in ancient Israel, the shofar played the same role that the church bell did in medieval Europe. It summoned the community to meeting, to assembly. It warned them of impending attack or challenged them to rally to the walls against some enemy. It announced the coming of the new year, the coming of the new moon. The oldest description of the new year's, the Rosh Hashanah in our Bible, uses these nouns: Shabbaton, Zikaron Truah, Mikra Kodesh, a day of holy rest, day consecrated by the sound of the shofar, the Truah, a holy convocation. At first, the ceremony must have been quite simple. The shofar was simply the rally, the summons. Come to the square of the city, come to the altar to offer the ceremony to God. The New Year's Day was a significant day. And our people were unwilling to leave the shofar in its simplicity. They wove into its call the basic teachings of our faith, the teachings that we ought to remember, they said, during each year, during the coming year. And they did so by tying to the shofar a number of references to it found in the biblical text itself. Thus we find in the book of Exodus that when Moses and the children of Israel were approaching Mount Sinai, where Moses would receive the commandments and the children of Israel would affirm the covenant, their progress was surrounded by kol shofar chazak ma'od, the blast of the shofar in rising crescendo. And using this text, our teachers wove into the New Year's Day all of the duties and of the obligations which came to us because of Sinai. They looked ahead into the new year. They saw it as full of possibility. But our people had no time or patience with empty and innocent hope. That possibility could be man's only if man was worthy of it. Only if he was willing to discipline himself and to obey the law, the right, to do his duty. The future is not fated. The future is not written down. Our destiny is not in the stars, but in ourselves, in our willingness to do the right, to obey God's will. So the shofar associated Rosh Hashanah with Mount Sinai, with the law. And a simple celebration of the new moon of the new year became a sacred celebration of reconsecration and of commitment. And this theme was deepened by another biblical illusion, a biblical illustration. In the book of Genesis, we are told that Abraham, the first Jew, the prototypical man, that Abraham who made the first covenant with God, who was the first to say, I will obey God's will, that Abraham was put to the test, as ultimately each of us is put to the test of our ideals and of our verbal professions. And the test was an awful one. He was told to sacrifice that which was more precious to him than life itself, his only son, Isaac. And Abraham was equal to the test. And God, of course, in the last moment was unwilling to take from Abraham another's life, the life of his son. And according to the biblical legend, instead of the son bound on the altar. Suddenly a ram was caught in a thicket nearby, a surrogate sacrifice. The ram was caught by its horn, and according to our tradition, that horn is the great horn of hope, the great shofar of deliverance. It was taken up by the angels and taken up to heaven. And there the prophet Isaiah said, in the end of days it shall be sounded, and all the exiles shall be gathered in into the Holy Land. And the apocalyptics and the visionaries saw a time, a messianic time, when that great shofar would be sounded, and all that is crooked would be made straight, all that is evil would be rectified, and man would live in peace and in freedom. And the rabbis added their hope, and they said that when that great horn was sounded, not only would the Messiah come and Israel been redeemed and the exiles be gathered in, but the dead would be reborn. All of men's hopes would be fulfilled when the great shofar would be blown. Duty, sacrifice, hope, the great triad, basic truths of Jewish thought. All of them were associated with the sound of the shofar. All of them are associated with our liturgy during the Rosh Hashanah day. So much for the tradition. And now a question. Has this tradition, however noble, however ancient, any bite to it? Any meaning? Or is it simply a footnote, a learned and recondite bit of the past? I was explaining the shofar the other day to a group, much as I've explained it to you this evening, and one of the young men who was there turned to me and said, "Rabbi Leboff, the shofar is a natural instrument. It can speak to me. I can have a genuine experience with the shofar. But I want nothing of your anecdotes, of your legends, of your truths, and of your traditions. You're giving me history. And I have no time for history. I live in me. This day, this moment, is the only reality for me." I asked him, "What then will the shofar mean to you come Rosh Hashanah?" And he answered, "I do not know. Whatever it means, it means. We'll see." Now the young man spoke with the language of his generation, but he spoke and found words and fit thoughts of a mood which is not generational, but pervasive among us. Our generation is burdened with civilization. We are tired of explanations. We have no patience with footnotes. This is a day of the happening, of immediacy, of the improvisation. We don't want to take our feelings and have them filtered through another, be told what we must do and how we must react to a given moment. We want to react to it openly. We have no patience, no patience with history. No patience with the learned, no patience with the closely reasoned. The emphasis is on the simple and the open. The artificial, that which is created by human artifice, art, is somehow not ours. The open, the instinctive, is our way of responding. The young, with their instinctive understanding, go further. Burdened by the complexity of the city, they seek the real commune. They find our tastes too precious and too refined, and they speak of natural foods and the simplest of diets. They look on dress as costume, and so they go about unshod and unbelted. But it's not a generational matter. Yes, their idiom bespeaks this drive for simplicity of which I speak. An occupation is simply getting bread. A place to live is simply a pad, a blanket on a floor. An aesthetic experience, an aesthetic pleasure is, hey, wow. But it's not simply the young. I've heard the not so young, the middle-aged, and those beyond middle-aged say to me again and again, Life is too complex. I'm cut up. I live in so many worlds, I don't know who I am anymore. I haven't got the energy to try to solve all the problems which face me. I turn on the news, and in 10 minutes, I'm presented with 20 colossal problems, each of them for 45 seconds, each of them infinitely complex. I don't know how to deal with them. And so I turn off the television. I've stopped reading the newspapers. I haven't got the emotional energy to face this life, this complexity, what we call civilization. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, civilization was what men dreamed of. As man would civilize himself, so peace and justice and freedom and learning would come into our world. But we know somehow deep down that civilization is not a pretty set of television evenings with Kenneth Clark, but civilization is the smog over the valley in our city. Civilization is the violence in the city street. Civilization is a human being reduced to holes in an IBM punch card. It's the brutalization and depersonalization of life. And so we seek simplicity. Once upon a time, country life was bucolic, rustic, uncouth. Now the good life is the country life, the simple life. Somehow we'll find ourselves not in the city where there is civilization, but in the country, touching the Mother Earth, going back to nature, back to the womb, back to our beginnings. For the young, it's the commune. For the not so young, it's Australia. Whatever the goal, the urge is the same. And that urge is understandable. For civilization has made us chopped up people. We are parents. We are husbands or wives. We have a particular profession. We are citizens of a certain country. We are committed to certain ideals. We are devoted to a certain religion, and each of these values, each of these worlds has a different culture. Each demands of us and sets forth to us a different set of priorities. Each would have us to be wholly committed to it. Each pulls us in a different way. We are pulled and pulled and turned and twisted. We want to be ourselves, simple, integrated human beings. We are chopped up people, and we are badgered people. Every day, 1,000 voices to us offer us solutions, nostrums to the problems of the world. And each of the solutions offers to us conflicts with the one that we were given before. We are offered an old morality and a new morality, and no morality. We are told to be close to our family, to give our children freedom. We are told to keep close the ties of love, and we are told of the importance of the erotic experience of the liberation of Eros. We don't know what to think. We're given so much to think about, we're given so many options and so many opportunities that we don't stand anymore in any single place. To our fathers, all that I told you at the beginning about the shofar was natural as the air that they breathed. They knew it, they had been taught these traditions from the cradle. Most of us have to be told these traditions by a rabbi on Rosh Hashanah night. They're not instinctive to us, natural to us. We're instructed in them. We are chopped up people, and we are badgered people. And more than this, we are to a certain degree unmanned. For once upon a time, however rigorous life was, men had a sense that they could control the immediate surroundings of their existence. But today, we have to depend upon others. We have to depend on others to manage our relationships with our government, all the complicated forms and procedures. We have to use others to explain to us what we should eat and how we maintain the health of our body. And when a doctor tries to explain to us his art and his learning, we hardly understand what he means. And so it is in all of our relationships, even in the simplest of relationships. Our children are being taught by experts with symbols and with forms that are not instinctive to us. Indeed, we hardly understand them. And because we are dependent upon so many experts, because we no longer have a sense that life is within our control, we're frustrated and anxious and embittered. Unmanned to a certain degree, badgered by 1,000 impressions, 1,000 different values coming at us, different explanations, different panaceas, cut up, chopped up in our lives. Is it any wonder that so many of us long for the simplicities of another year that never was, another life that existed or perhaps only exists in our imaginations? I share these feelings. I too seek to be whole, one. I too am pulled this way and that. But the question I put before you is whether simplicity, openness, the casting aside of learning, of the inherited wisdom of mankind, what we call civilization, the disparagement of the past, of all of its learning and of all of its institutions, whether this in fact is the way to achieve the wholeness, the integrity, the simple life, the sense of peace of spirit which we seek. I'm troubled. I'm troubled because simplicity may be folly. I know of people who have responded instinctively to their emotions and regretted it for a lifetime. You can be attracted to a paranoid. You can be attracted to a person who is simply charismatic, who is not for you. And I keep remembering that the first time I heard men counsel other men to cast off the conventions of the society, not to be trammeled by the past, to be free spirits, to listen to their instincts, to listen to their blood, the voice was guttural and the voice was in German. It was a Nazi speaking to Hitler's youth. Those who speak to us as if there is something naturally good about man, that if we could somehow revert to the primitive, we would be basically decent, lie. The caveman was not only ignorant, but a brute, and brutal. He was a creature of instinct. He reacted aggressively to anything which he felt attacked him or those whom he felt a responsibility to protect. His life was narrow and circumscribed and filled with fear, and he was a dangerous creature. Yes, man today is a dangerous and aggressive beast, but we have come far from being a human animal. And many of us manage to live with a degree of peacefulness in society, sublimating our more aggressive instincts. There is no such thing as the natural goodness of men. And those who exuberantly describe for us the sensitivity and the service of the young, how they, in their disparagement of the city, disparagement of civilization, of our institution, have gone out on their own to the gray parts of our communities, to the slums, to the poor, and to the outcast, and given them of their love, and given them justice, and given them of themselves, describe the act truthfully. But these young people are not acting out of any primal instinct for goodness. They were conditioned from the cradle in the values of Western civilization, in their homes and in their schools, without their knowing that they were given a conscience which talked to them of love and of God and of duty and of morality. Conscience is not a given. It's not something which is genetic. It's a capacity. And conscience can be aggressive, it can be calculating, it can be generous, it can be filled with the values of one civilization, any set of values, depending upon the way in which a young person was reared, the first few years of his life. The achievement of these young people is, in a perverse way, the achievement of Western civilization, the very thing which so many of them disparage. But what of the pressures? What of the fact that we are chopped up into so many little parts? What of the fact that so many of us are confused as to what our values really are? It's not that we're not willing to commit ourselves to our values, it's that we simply don't know what we believe. How shall we find what we believe? How shall we integrate the many pressures, blend together the many worlds, the many cultures in which we walk and act and work? Shucking off civilization, I submit, is not the way. Keeping the shofar call bare, innocent of all historic illusion. But it's rather, I submit, to listen to the teachings which our faith has deliberately intertwined into the sounding of the shofar. Where does wisdom begin? There are two ways in which men have traditionally searched for wisdom, and only two. One is Greek, and one is Hebrew. The Greek way, the way which has been that of modern man these last 75 or 100 years or more, is symbolized by the motto which existed over the academy in ancient Athens. Know thyself. Socrates gave that way to man. Seek to understand yourself, and you will somehow cut through the superstitions and the incrustations and the customs which are handed down to you, and you will find the freedom and the truth that you seek. And Socrates lived a noble life, and Socrates died a noble death. But Socrates was the father of the cynics, of all who came after, who came to mock and to scoff, who were good at tearing down, but have never in history been able to build up a single consistent scheme of values which would allow man to say, this is the way I can live. Why not? Because there is no self. There is no thing in any one of us which we can scalpel out and place down and examine and say, this is the self, and there's no self in me, and there's no self in any of us. There is conscience, awareness. We are in constant flow between our senses and our mind and our experience. There is an exchange and an interchange. The self is a process. It is a growth. But it is never a thing fixed and final. And he who would seek for himself finds only process, endless change. And if we find process, each of us in ourselves, we are process multiplied 1,000 times over. The search leads to questions, searching, penetrating questions, but not to answers, not to values, not to an ultimate scheme of life. The other way, the Hebrew way, is typified by the motto which exists over the ark of many synagogues and has long existed there, know before whom you stand. Da lifnei mi ata omed. The Hebrew way was to leave off the ultimate questions, what is justice, what is truth, what is beauty, to concentrate on commandment. The Hebrew image was this. We live in a world of change and of confusion. The Jewish people has always been a people on the go, on a pilgrimage, going from one culture to another, always alienated, always the stranger. But wherever we were, whatever culture we were in, God in his grace had given us that law, a series of rights and wrongs, of do's and don'ts. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt establish community, thou shalt establish family, thou shalt give of thy substance because it is due to the community, thou shalt protect the naked, the widow, the orphan. And in whatever community we find ourselves, in whatever area of our life we are operating, these rules hold true. They are God's will. And if you obey them, Jew, Your life will have wholeness and integrity because at whatever level you lead it, in whatever world or culture you are now operating, if you apply these basic rules, they are one and the same. Judaism is a faith for men and women on the way. Where we are going, we know not. But along the way, whatever be the confusions, here are some basic rules, God's will. Abide it. And somehow, as you abide God's way, you will find that integrity, that simplicity of self, that peace with oneself which you seek. The ultimate questions will not be answered. All of the world's problems will not be solved. Our lives will be filled, as they have been filled again and again in the past, with 1,000 conflicts and 1,000 demands will be made upon us. But there will be a basic principle, guidelines to follow. A new year dawns. According to the religious calendar, it's the 5,732nd year of human history. Whatever be the number of years which this is of human history, it will be like all the years in the past. A year fraught with danger, a year of complexity, a year of strident noises, a year of violence, and a year of possibility. During that year, many will turn away in defeat and fear from the challenges, these overwhelming challenges which we all face. They will have sought within themselves for a truth which cannot be found within oneself. And life will somehow have broken them down. Seek the truth where God in His grace has given it. In the law. In the commandment. In all that the sound of the shofar signals to us tonight. And if you do, I do not promise you in the year ahead security or peace. I do not say that our lives will not be as filled with the unwanted black headline as they are now, that our worship may not be surrounded by the violence of the city. But I say to you that you will find the peace, the wholeness that you seek, that you will sleep well and work usefully and be satisfied that your lives are consecrated to the good, to God.